Not
really. All right. So how's Noise Square doing? It's hot. We're sweaty. Awesome. So I'm Antoine. This is Smurf and Sophie. We're going to talk to you about the Maple Spring, which is basically the student revolt and uprising that happened in Quebec and the province where we're from. It's in Canada. I may have heard of that thing across the Atlantic Ocean. Basically, it's something that basically shook our nation or whatever for the whole spring. And we're going to talk about how, you know, it's the usual pattern of government cutting taxes. And so they get less revenue. And now they need to do austerity measure to balance the budget. And then people like freak out and revolt. And we're going to talk about how this happened to us, but also the technological aspects and the media, how they twisted everything. So basically, Sophie is going to start with some history.
Hi, everyone. So basically, the student strike in Quebec is part of the history of remarkable events that happened in the past year and also in the past months that we have witnessed around the globe, which have included the recent Turkish, Brazilian, European anti-austerity protest, as well as the uprising in the Arab world, as well as the thousands of encampments that were affiliated with the Occupy movement. So the Maple Spring is in reference to the democratic uprising in the Arab world, which was, as you know, dubbed the Arab Spring. And so in Quebec, we called it the Arab Spring. The Maple Spring, basically because we have maple trees, and it was at a time where the maple syrup was started to be collected. So that's how the name was came from. So to understand the student strike, we need to understand it through a historical perspective of both the student protests, but also social movements that happen in Quebec. I guess the first thing that I can say is that the Quiet Revolution that started in the 1960s in Quebec, where the church was separated from the state, included a commitment to accessible French language higher education, as well as the creation of a tuition-free system of preparatory colleges. And also a shared understanding of the important role that cultural and educational institutions are in Quebec in defending and preserving our culture within a predominantly English-speaking Canada. So that's, I think, very important to understand where the student strikes come from. And I guess over the past decades, there were multiple student strikes, but in 2012, the mobilization was the biggest in the history of Quebec, where at its peak, there basically were 175,000 students that were on strike, which is over half of all the post-secondary students. There is, as well, a long history of social movement that we need to factor in, and that was a good breeding ground for the 2000 student strike. And so, if I go roughly among some of these events, there is in Quebec, there was Indie Media was crucial in reporting the 2001 Summit of Quebec, where three heads of states of Canada, of the US, and of Mexico met up. As well, there was a big march that was organized during, against the war in Iraq, where roughly 100,000 to 150,000 Quebecers took the street to voice their concern about the war. There was also, in 2006, there was a huge demonstration against the summit of the head of states, which again was held between the US, the Canada, and Mexico, where they wanted to bring together or create a security prosperity partnership. And so there was a lot of police brutality in this demonstration, and but the work of independent journalists was crucial in revealing agents provocateurs that were in the protest. So another more recent event that we can discuss and which is important to understand the student strike is Occupy Montreal. So basically on October 15, 2011, the Global Day of Action, inspired by the Arab Spring, by the Icelandic Revolution, by the M15 movement in Spain, and obviously the Occupy Wall Street movement, among others, led in Montreal to the creation of Occupy Montreal. And so the encampment was a new fixture in the financial district landscape of Montreal, where people really voiced their, well, more than their concern that the financial system was plaguing a majority and, plaguing a majority. So in early 2010, the Liberal Party of Quebec, led by former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, announced his intention of increasing the tuition fees by 75%, beginning in 2012. And this would basically result in a total increase of 1,625 dollars that would bring the tuition fees at par with other provinces in Canada. And the government basically explained the increase in tuition fees by saying that the student needed to they needed to pay their fair share. And so many... Yeah, so... Yeah, so basically on February the 13th, Student Association declared unlimited student strike. And and he's not happy at all because the student, you know, declare unlimited student strike. So yeah, okay.
And this is pretty much when the actual repression started. There was a few demonstrations that were that happened before that went relatively well. And on March 7th, there was a blockade at the locals of all the administrators of all the local universities. There are six major universities in Montreal, and all the heads of the universities are in sort of a union. The students went to do a blockade there, which was absolutely peaceful. There was no vandalism or anything. They were simply blocking the entrance. But they were violently repressed by the police while they were gathered, not marching and just waiting in front of the building. The police started throwing rubber ball grenades, which are essentially flashbangs with tear gas inside. Which are supposed to explode against above people's head, but obviously they often fall in the crowd. And as we saw in other countries, as we saw in France quite a few times, one of them exploded within the crowd, and a protester who was sitting playing music actually lost an eye from the shrapnel. And this is when we started seeing
more and more demonstrations. The response of the demonstrators after this was quite powerful. Only a week after, we had our first major incident. We had the yearly March 15th anti-police brutality march, which was a record march in Montreal in its 15 years history. We see where we usually it's a relatively small protest. We have a couple hundred people showing up usually. This year we saw probably between 2,000 and 5,000 people. And they started. They tried for the first time at this point a kettle, which did not work. They were actually trying to kettle the whole group, a few thousand people, but they didn't manage to. And most of them fled. They started walking downtown. There was a lot of confrontation downtown in smaller groups, but nevertheless, the vandalism was still quite minimal, except for one police car that was left there for unattended for many hours in downtown and ended up being turned over. And thus ended the major part of the vandalism during the whole movement. As there were no other cop car that was burnt or turned around or anything like this. And right away the police blamed the protesters. People started going in the streets having daily night demonstrations. There were in 2007, according to the Montreal police, over 700 demonstrations. And it's quite amazing that through all these demonstrations, you can probably count the number of real vandalism on your hands. So it was extremely peaceful, especially even night protests, which have a tendency to degenerate quite fast, remain really peaceful, and more people would gather, and you would see a lot more groups from the teachers that wanted to participate in the demonstrations. And I can point out that all three of us are actually in the picture holding some of the really big red flags there. So it's we. And I think we have a little small video of this particular protest. Meanwhile... I guess the video is not playing, sorry. So... What happened then is that about a week after March 15th, on March 22nd, there were more than half the student body that were on strike, and a lot of supporting groups from the parents, the teachers, and other unions that decided to start coming out in the street. And we saw the largest ever demonstration in the history of Canada, and we had about 250,000 people in the streets. And this was repeated for about four times each month for the following months. And again, this demonstration was absolutely peaceful. There was not a single case of vandalism or anything bad happening. If you compare it to the population of Montreal, which is about 2-3 million people, if you include the metro area, that's roughly 10% of the population was in the street at this point. So there was a huge amount of arrests. They would do, as I said, a lot of kettling, a lot of single arrests. They would go and fish people in the streets just because they thought they looked wrong. If you were dressed in black, you had a good chance of getting picked up in the streets, even if you hadn't committed anything. In 2004, the stats range of about 4,000 arrests. During the conflict, out of which resulted in less than 250 criminal charges. And most of these criminal charges, a fair amount have already been dropped. A lot of them were for absolutely ridiculous things, such as death threats for pointing at a police officer. Probably about half of them are also dubious charges of resisting arrest or obstructing justice, which you see as more often a single charge of resisting arrest without any actual charge of an offense, and so a lot of these arrests were actually only for municipal offenses, such as blocking traffic or or crossing on a red light and things like that.
So what we began to see in Montreal was that more and more any demonstration that had a political purpose or a social message was being kettled. This is about like at least half or three quarters of the march that was just surrounded, including tourists that were sitting by, because this is downtown Montreal, port, and a lot of people just go around strolling there. And they basically arrested everyone. I was about here. And it was a pretty traumatic event, and it kept on happening again and again. And Montreal police has become very effective at doing mass arrests. So they have various tactics of following the crowd and keeping the police hidden until they intervene in like one flash move and they surround everybody. And people, like sometimes they just, you know, they have like a few cops around, like say like five cops here. So there's space to go through the police line, but people are scared. They don't confront the police because we're all like civil and like, ooh, nice little citizens. And so they can just arrest everyone, and people are like, whoa, this is unfair. What's going on? And then they give tickets to everyone, and you know, you get processed into the criminal system. And so what happened is that the relationship between the citizens and the police became really tense. And now a lot of people are afraid of to go demonstrating in the street because they are afraid of being arrested. And then on the other side too, like when the police patrol the streets regularly, there's much more tension than it used to be in the streets because people are scared and annoyed. You wanted to add something? So this was possible because the media weren't saying people are arresting everybody in the street. They were saying they were criminals, they were dangerous. And what this graph shows is the change in the coverage of the media during the strike. So this is early February going all the way to April. And we don't see the legend here because I fucked it up. But basically, the blue line is the percentage of time dedicated to covering the students' demands and the politics and why they're there. That's the Y is the blue line that basically goes down like this. And the orange part is the violence, the demonstrations. So as the movement actually got stronger and more people were going in the street, the media were covering more of the violence and less of the politics. And the message was very often, we don't know what they want. You know, like the Occupy movement, what the people were saying, like, we don't know what they want. We don't know where they're there. They don't even know where they're there. Like, they're complaining for nothing. And so, and they're burning the street. You know, they're turning everything around, and they're like, you know, babies that, you know, they're complaining with their mouth full. And so that the reason why the police were able to just arrest everybody and beat up people randomly is because the media was complacent and basically saying, this is all right. And they are terrorists. And in fact, we have a case of terrorists in Montreal. We have like dangerous terrorists, and Smurf's going to tell us about that.
So a little bit after, some of the protesters, or allegedly some of the protesters, decided to do a direct action in the subway of Montreal, and they deployed the smoke bombs in the subway in one of the major stations, pretty much the central hub of the Montreal subway. And they were what happened is the subway was obviously closed. It was evacuated, and it was closed for 3 hours. But what we know from testimonies and people that came forth after employees of the transit system is that, for example, the testimonies told us that the firefighters and the emergency crews knew exactly what they were dealing with. Nobody came in with a hazmat suit. They didn't have gas masks on. They knew from the odor of the smoke that it was just a smoke bomb. There was nothing to worry about. And we knew from previous incidents also that clearing this specific station, which had been upgraded after 9/11 to clear smoke in the subway station, should have taken about 5 or 10 minutes. There was actually very little smoke in the subway. But they closed it for 3 hours, probably to get the general population to really be frustrated against the student. It didn't seem to work. We saw interviews. The media was really going in the streets and asking people, "Are you mad that the students did this?" Even though we didn't know who actually did it, and people were were really realizing what was going on at this point. Most people answered things like, well, you know, it's hard for everybody. I'm stuck in traffic. What do you want? These people are fighting for a cause too. And or why do you think it's a student? We don't know this yet. This just happened. And we started to see that people were less and less following what the media was saying. But these people actually faced terrorist charges under the Canadian Criminal Code, which were later dropped, obviously, because nobody was afraid, nobody was hurt, nobody was terrorized in the street.
The reason why those people got caught is that people took pictures of them on their cell phone. And there was this huge media thing. The police came on the media saying, we have pictures of those people. We want to find them, identify them. And so first off, people shared the pictures, say, I saw who did this, and basically took, like, they could have been a picture of me, for Christ's sake, you know? They did, like, a picture of random person, looks like a student, it's probably him, and put them online, or put them, like, send them to the police. And then the police get those pictures and says, those are the bad guys, identify them. And they were identified this way. And the reason why I chose this picture is because those are kids. I mean, they're young men and women, but they're made to look like fucking jailmates, you know, that they robbed the bank, or they you know, this guy, I don't know, he skinned the cat or something, you know. They're just fucking student that put a smoke bomb in the metro. Little jokes, you know, like they did a prank. And now they were tried as terrorists. So this is very, very creepy for me.
And so what happened after is that the Liberal Party had their yearly congress, which they had to move for obvious reasons. So they moved it to a small town called Victoriaville, which is about an hour and a half drive from Montreal, where they had a convention center that was heavily guarded by the provincial police. And there, obviously, protesters organized a demonstration there. They organized buses from all across the province to go there and had a quite peaceful march, which ended in front of the convention center, where they had installed a very light gate in front, just one of those, the same gate that's protecting the street there, which you can hop very easily. And we saw the first very hardcore black bloc action, which was to take down the fence and stay there, not move until the riot police actually formed the line behind it to protect the building. And then they did their second action, very violent action, of taking the fence and putting it in front of the riot police and then starting to chant slogan again in a peaceful manner. I admittedly, there were a couple of paint bombs that were thrown, but that's about the extent of the violence, or the violence that happened there. But what happened later is that the provincial police started gassing everybody. The crowd had a lot of kids in there, a lot of children, a lot of elderly people. There were a lot of unions that were there. It was a bit less of a student demonstration. And they just indiscriminately gassed everyone and very shortly after starting shooting plastic bullets in the crowd. And as soon as they started shooting plastic bullets, we started seeing casualties. Very, very shortly after the first bullet was shot, someone got shot in the head and was put in a coma for 3 days. The medics that were on the site actually tried to get the ambulance to come, but the riot police would not let the ambulance through. One of the TV crews, or independent TV crews that was there, actually went to the police and said, guys, someone's actually seriously injured. We need an ambulance. Please send an ambulance. And to which the chief or the sergeant replied, call 911. And later, this kept on going for a while. They pushed people. They started shooting more plastic bullets. Another person got hurt. She got hit in the face. Her jaw was fractured in multiple places. We know exactly which plastic bullets they are. We have videos that came off the same day. What happened is they kept getting pushed a little bit further, and then it took about an hour for everybody to gather back in a parking lot or a vacant lot that was close by, and by then everybody knew there were some seriously injured people. Everybody got angry. Obviously, everybody was talking on Twitter, and the news was going around. And the protesters, being really, really angry, decided to trash the police bus that was parked there, one of the riot cops. So they trashed the bus, and a lone policeman decided he would do an arrest by himself in the crowd of one of the person that threw a rock, which there was a couple dozen people. Obviously, this didn't fare very well for this policeman, who actually didn't get injured very seriously. But one of his colleagues thought it was a good idea to rescue him to drive into the crowd with his vehicle, which sparked even more anger. And he did manage to get his colleague out, and more plastic bullets were shot. Someone else got hit in the head from very close by, about 10 meters. This person lost an eye and an ear and was also in a coma for a couple of days. But all you saw in the media that night was the very small clip of about 5 or 10 seconds where you don't see what happens before, you don't see what happens, you don't even see the car going inside of just people jumping on the lone policeman. And with absolutely no context and absolutely no mention that he was safe, that he was not injured. They mention other injuries of the policeman, but from all that we can tell, there are usually just sprained ankles from running after the protesters. And then the provincial police came on and said, well, we heard that people got hurt during the demonstration, but we're absolutely sure that it's not us. These people got hurt before we started shooting plastic bullets, and they were too far to get shot to be hurt from plastic bullets, which we know is absolutely false. And it still took about a year for the main mass media to come out with a story, even though all the proof was on the internet on the same day or the same weekend.
So eventually what happened is that to quell the basically what became a popular revolt, well, it was mostly student at the time, but they couldn't deal with it. The strike wasn't ending, so a majority of students were on strike and they were not going back to class. It was pretty clear. And negotiations were going nowhere because the government didn't really want to negotiate. And so basically they just stopped pretending at some point and says, we're going to make a special law, which was Bill 78. And Bill 78 was designed to forbid demonstrations. So basically you had to get approval from the police before making a demonstration with any more than 50 people. They were forbidding blocking universities. So you couldn't make a picket line anymore to just block the building to enforce the students' decisions of making a strike. They also made associations, unions, student unions, all those organizations responsible for what happens in demonstrations. So if the organizers make a demo, they become legally responsible for it. And for an organization, it can mean like hundreds of thousands of dollars of fines. For individual people, it's like $1,000, $5,000 if you demonstrate while that law, like break that law, basically. It also suspended the session so that people, were said, like, you're going to go back to class in August now because we can't deal with this anymore. They just stopped it. And they forced the worker, because the worker were also refusing to attend the classes, like the teachers and the support staff were just saying, well, the students are on strike, so we're not coming to work. And they were basically saying, well, you need to go back to work, otherwise you get, penalties on your, ancienneté, whatever. You get fees, fines and all that. So that didn't go so well. This is what we call the casserole. People were, elsewhere in the world, Chile and other places, people were going out in the street, on the street corners, and just banging their pots together like you saw, And because they weren't allowed to do demonstration, they were still allowed to go outside and walk from one street corner to the other, and they wander, that's legal. So they were basically doing that, and they were not more than 50 people. It's like the family. It's just that it kept on happening night after night after night. At 8 o'clock, people would go out in the street. Anybody that was in Montreal at that time, has a very clear memory of that, because you're just like, what's that noise? So, it's a casserole again. You just go out with your little pans and pots and your pan. And then what happened is that people were at every street corner, right? And they were walking like this, and more people were coming. So at some point, you couldn't walk from one street corner to the other because the whole intersection was taken over by random people, elderly, children, banging their pots. They were really happy, and families and all kinds of things. It was just absolutely amazing. And basically, it was just creating random demos everywhere. So you'd like have nights where you had like 10 demos at the same time. They were like not demos. They were just like people walking in the street like that with cars. So I was like, yay! Like la loi spéciale, like we don't care. Fuck it. Fuck the special law. And like basically because people felt that their basic freedoms were eroded. Like those were not students anymore. This was the general population. Everybody was going in the street saying like, what? You don't want us to demonstrate anymore? We can't go in the street? Like, fuck it. We're going to go in the street like crazy. And it's going to be legal. We're just going to bang our pots and walk around. And so basically that kind of didn't work, that Bill 78. But it passed it anyways. Even the Lawyers Guild, like the Quebec Bar, protested against the law. Those people never go in demonstrations. And it's not like they're nice people. Some of them are nice. You know, well, they help us anyway sometimes. But they never contest the law because the law is canon. It's like a sacred thing, you know. They accept the law from the government. It's kind of a political. It's kind of tricky. Yeah. Well, in Quebec. Right, so our lawyers never took the street against any law before. That was like really a first. And you see quite a lot of people there. And most of them had little color things like that. They're really fancy clothes. So like various tactics started to emerge. Like there were like nightly protests still and various like kind of blockades and all sorts of things. But then you had the lawyers kicking in and the casserole. And then there were other like ways that this worked forward.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about the media involvement or the independent media involvement in the strikes, because it was very, very present and it helped a lot people that were on the street break the message that the mass media were putting forth. One of the main groups to do this. Obviously, there were a lot of people streaming their 3G on Ustream right now. It's quite popular with the Occupy movement and whatnot. But one group in particular, the CUTV, the Concordia University University TV, got themselves one of the live U backpacks and became very quickly the single largest stream or single most viewed stream on live stream, with over 6,000 or 8,000 people watching at the same time. And what is very interesting is that the mass media journalists were very jealous of them, because they were there from the beginning of the demo, beginning of when the people gathered, all the way to the end, the dispersion. They saw everything. They were getting gassed within the demonstration. Some of them were getting arrested. And the mass media were very jealous because they come in with the big trucks, they park at a street corner, and then they get a view of a street corner for 10, 15, 20 minutes. And if they want to move, it's going to take another half hour or 45 minutes to move, and they miss all of the action. So they don't really have a very good view from inside the demonstration and a good global view of what's going on in the demonstration. So CUTV was very, very helpful in this movement. And obviously, yeah, so we saw that traditional media is not catching up, and we saw a whole lot of independent media creation. There were artist groups that started specifically for the strikes, like L'École de la Montagne Rouge, je crois. So there that were just producing content for the strike. A lot of songs were produced, video clips and whatnot. And a lot of anonymous videos.
So the presence of Anonymous was ubiquitous during the student strike. Anonymous released many videos that supported the student strike. And there was one video that was very important, and that was basically showing the Prime Minister of Quebec attending a party with George Bush, with former Canadian prime ministers, and also some multinational owners. And so that video was released during the student strike, and it triggered even more anger among the population. And as well, what we can say in terms of the Guy Fawkes mask that we see, it was one of the first time that there was so many masks that were that people wear at during the student strike. And it was people from all ages, all gender, all ethnicity. So it was really visible during the strike. And when the wearing of a mask started to be illegal, then people continued to wear them, but backwards. Another important figure of the student strike movement was this panda over here, which was basically called Anarcho Panda. And so you can, you know, guess his politics. And so the man behind the panda was a philosophy professor at one of the colleges in Quebec. And basically his goal was at first to give hugs to police officers. But police officers did not want to receive any hugs from, you know, a random and weird, like, guy wearing, you know, a panda head or in a panda costume. The panda decided to, you know, turn to the activists who welcomed the hugs and welcome also the nonviolence and the philosophy of anarchism that, you know, was behind his figure. And when the wearing of a mask was started to be illegal during the student strike, his head was actually seized by the police, and it was in a police station under investigation for about 3 days. we don't really know what they were investigating in, you know, the head of the panda, but it was later on given back to his owner. Something else that we can say is that during the student strike, we could hear on the police radio channel the police referring to Anarcho Panda as Philippe the Panda and not Anarcho Panda. And so one can wonder if the police, you know, thought it was inappropriate to refer to anarchism on the police channel. Even more peculiar is that journalists that were working for corporate media were actually, in their article, using Philippe the Panda rather than Anarcho Panda. And so one can wonder if the journalists were actually doing their job of going out in the street and interviewing people and understanding what's happening in the streets, or were they armchair journalists? So just, you know, in their office listening to a radio channel.
So they did a couple things. Sophie mentioned that they outlawed masks. They passed two laws actually at the same time. When they passed Bill 78, they actually passed a municipal bylaw in Montreal that is this very, very close to Bill 78, forbids gatherings of more than actually in Montreal is more than three people is an illegal assembly. It forbids wearing masks, and it's more peculiar is it makes any offense in a demonstration liable, or it makes the whole demonstration liable for any offense in the demonstration. So if a single person is wearing a mask in a demonstration, the police is allowed to declare the whole demonstration legal and kettle everybody. What happened after the Bill 78 got really, really big support from, or got really big attention from the population, and demonstrations started getting a really big support. An election was called, and the other leading party won the election. And everybody said, "Well, we're tired now. We've been fighting for almost a year. We want to see what's going to go on, what's going to happen now. The new government promised to have a summit on education where it could be discussed the future of education, of the cost of education." And this summit actually happened in February 2013, so about almost 6 months later. But people decided to wait a little bit, and we didn't see any demonstrations or anything happening for from about October, from the election, all the way to February when this summit happened. But this summit happened in February, and what we saw was that the government had their preconceived idea. It was they boasted it as a way to talk about it, to have a discussion with different people, different speakers, but they actually only had a two-day summit where they expressed the fact that they would, instead of raising the fees 78%, they would actually 75%, they would actually just raise it by inflation and keep raising it by inflation yearly. They would start indexing it. So this obviously sparked a lot of anger. There was a demonstration, I believe it was the 20th of February, that got repressed quite quickly, although there were only a couple of arrests. But this started again the cycle of demonstrations in Montreal. And a little bit after came the 15th of March. And the 15th of March was obviously going to be quite big. A lot of people were still angry because of last year. We probably were going to get about 1,500 people coming to the 15th of March. And what happened is that the police right away started being very, very aggressive with the demonstrators. They would see someone with a mask inside the crowd and would take a crew of about six riot cops and walk straight inside the crowd and fish out the people to arrest them, or they would recognize people that were under conditions of not going to demonstrations, which happened to a lot of activists that were caught the previous year. So you have to understand that the judicial procedures are very, very long. Most of them have not yet seen their trial. A lot of them are going to see it in 2 or 3 years. So a lot of them have conditions for 2 or 3 years of not participating in the demonstration.
So what happened here is that so they changed the party. There were elections. There were promises that we're going to remove Bill 78. We're gonna freeze the student fees, or we're going to talk about it. So what they ended up doing is raising the student fees anyways. They removed Law 78. They removed the bill, but they had other bills they can use. And they actually cracked down on demonstrations a lot more. There used to be like nightly demonstrations. Every night there would be a demonstration, and very often people would get arrested, but not all the time. And there were so many demonstrations that happened all the time that they couldn't do it. They couldn't arrest everybody. But after the new party came in power, they arrested everybody. All the time. Like, no demonstrations were allowed anymore, basically. That's what happened. So they just cracked down on everything like crazy. Which is completely backwards when you think about it, because it's supposed to be the new party, the elections, they're supposed to change things. And somehow they didn't change anything. I don't know how that works. Maybe I missed some class at school or something.
So this started another cycle. Just after the 15th of March, people were obviously angry because of the 15th of March, of what happened. They ended up kettling a bunch of people. They arrested about 450 people this day. There was another demonstration about a week or two after against the P6 bylaw. Meanwhile, criminal bill C-310, if I remember properly, passed in Canada, which forbids masks, but makes it a criminal offense to wear a mask in an illegal assembly. Which is punishable by up to 5 years in prison for wearing a mask in a criminal in an unlawful assembly, which is not a riot. It's a gathering that could make you think that it would turn into a riot, and up to 10 years in prison for wearing a mask during a riot. And so there is another demonstration that happened to against P6, specifically against the P6 bylaw, where people gathered at a square. And P6 bylaw has a lot of conditions, such as you're not allowed walking in the opposite direction of traffic. So people would gather at a square, and what the police would do is they would make a really, really big circle around the square where people were meeting. It was actually almost impossible to get to the square. So if we were expecting about 2,000 people to show up to a demonstration, maybe 400 people would actually make it there. And you could walk around the circle that they had formed and see a lot of people not even being able to get in. And what they would do is they would block all the streets around this this square where people met for the past year, except one street that was going against traffic. And so the demonstration starts. Obviously, people start marching. They go across the square. They go, and then they see that everything is blocked off. They go across the square again, and they decide to take this only one street that's not blocked. Obviously, the police is waiting for them only a block or two after, and they kettle everybody, and they arrest about 400 people. And so between, and this happened another week, week or two after, for the one-year anniversary of the one of the really large demonstrations, they did exactly the same thing and ended up arresting 1,500 people in about a month and a half. And these are purely under municipal offenses, but you're talking about $650 fines. Which is roughly equivalent to a month of rent for a student in Montreal. And what we saw is that the police became very, very paranoid, and they started going after people for absolutely ridiculous things. As I mentioned before, they would arrest people for pointing at the police, and they would say, well, he had a gun in his hand, so this is a death threat. And what they did is they found this person who had an Instagram account with a bunch of Antifa pictures, and she had taken a picture of a graffiti, which you can see here, and we're going to display it, and a graffiti that she's found in the city of Montreal. And this graffiti is the Montreal police spokesperson, Ian Lafreniere, with a bullet in his head. Someone tried to put some strawberries in his forehead, and it leaked all over. And so she was arrested at 6 a.m. at her house. They came and picked her up and charged her with death threats. And this probably had not the effect that they were intended. They actually did not remove the image from, didn't get the image removed from Instagram, so it started a really big Streisand effect. I did a little bit of searching. I found about a dozen articles, international articles, as far as Poland, Turkey, and other countries, at least a few dozen national articles. But what was very, very peculiar about the national articles and some of the other articles was that they had, they displayed this picture also in the article to show why she was arrested, but they took a picture that was different than hers and was more recent than hers, because on hers you can see part of it is ripped off and their pictures was not. So I don't know where they found the picture, but they already had a picture of the graffiti that she was arrested for taking a picture of.
That was taken before she took that picture.
Right. And despite that, the mass media went against her. In a lot of editorials, tried to call her a Nazi because, for example, she had taken a picture of an SS helmet in an army surplus store. Even though she had a bunch of Antifa picture in her in the rest of her Instagram account, they still pounded her as being a Nazi and whatnot. And so this is what happened. They just became very, very paranoid. They saw dead police chiefs everywhere.
So I think that's about it for what we had to present. Like we have like this one video. It's about 6 minutes that explains pretty well what happened. It has some like riot porn and images of demonstrations. But we'd also be happy to take questions and discuss this. So I don't know if people have questions we can take now and maybe move on to the video after, because we have like 8 minutes left.
And obviously, this was a long struggle. There's a lot of material that's not covered in there, or maybe not very much in depth. So if you have questions, or if you guys want to meet afterwards and talk about it, we'd be glad to.